Janie Hoft.
The first thing I want to say is that we are treating this meeting and this gathering here today as an attorney-client privileged meeting. We believe that those of you who have come today are seeking legal advice, and that although our opinions may not fit every situation and you should consult for specific advice with specific attorneys from time to time, we are all lawyers and we express our opinions based on our training and our experience. Therefore, under the consent decree in the Red Squad spying case, 76C 1982, law enforcement may not conduct any surveillance of this meeting or this gathering, and that any member of law enforcement who happens to be here should now identify themselves or absent themselves from the meeting. Okay? So I just wanted to say that and say a little bit about, this is kind of an example of some of the things that law can do, as Nick said, after the fact. And in the March 20th case, which I'll talk about a little later too, that's been pending for about 18 months, and we still don't have a decision on the class action formation of the case. So the adage, the wheels of justice grind slow, is quite true. But in the 70s, the Chicago police had a particular unit of the police department called the Red Squad, which was routinely, wholesalely, and completely surveilling activists and spying on activists at meetings, both public and private. And this was exposed by this litigation that I mentioned that resulted in a consent decree that did curtail this illegal spying at that time. Now I'll talk a little bit more about changes that have happened to that since the 70s, but I think as we all know and as we all embrace, the United States includes a rich tradition of demonstrations and street protests, and that social change has been forged by organizing people to expressly and publicly express their opinions. However, the rights of demonstrators and the police response to us has sort of been a pendulum which swings based on changing public opinion, government fear and repression, and more increasingly with worldwide opinion and global conditions. So my contention is that those factors do figure into how the police respond to street protests at any given point, and that in particular in the last 5 years we've seen what law enforcement called the battle for Seattle, followed by the events of September 11th and the advent of repressive legislation such as the Patriot Act, that police have increasingly focused on preventing what they call civil disobedience rather than protecting free speech and assembly, which many of us may believe that should be a function of the police, to protect our right and in fact our duty and obligation under the Constitution to dissent and express our dissenting opinions. There are, however, signs of hope in public opinion and in the courts and in municipal efforts to get municipalities to change the police response to demonstrations, and that we hope that this trend will continue. I mean, as we all know, we're looking at rights in the context of the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, and I think what we'll be talking about is the First Amendment, that specifically says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of people to peaceably to assemble and to petition their government for redress of grievances. That's it. That's our protection, our bulwark, really what we're talking about. Also, the Fourth Amendment and our right to be secure in our person and our effects and our houses and to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. So oftentimes we will sue under the Fourth Amendment for what's called false arrest or an unreasonable seizure. And then also the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination, and in fact the right to be silent, which is a right I think that we cannot emphasize too much. because it is difficult to assert when there is a prevailing public opinion that why would you be silent if you didn't have something to hide? So that's something that we need to continue to debunk, I think, and we can't reiterate that enough. I think we all know since the Revolutionary War, since the Boston Tea Party, there have been street demonstrations that have made real change in this country through the 50s and the labor movement and the civil rights movement, during the Vietnam War. And this again brings us back to the Red Squad spying suit, where the police were getting out of control in the way that they, even more control than generally, in how they were spying on people's constitutionally protected rights to assemble and express their First Amendment rights. In the 80s, we saw the Central American Solidarity Movement, anti-nuclear, the Iranian students, all participating in a rich tradition of protest and sit-ins and demonstrations. And in the 90s, the Million Man March, the Million More movement that's occurring today, the ACT UP groups, gay rights groups, anti-choice and women's groups, the Irish groups, Rodney King riots. During the Rodney King riots in 1992, there were 500 people arrested in Los Angeles and held those individuals up to 55 hours. But in the last 5 years, again, really it's my contention that since late November, early December, when huge demonstrations occurred over a period of days targeting the World Trade Organization's meetings in Seattle, that police around the country were motivated by the events in Seattle. They really did come together to respond to what they saw happening in the Northwest. And law enforcement agencies around the country began showing stark and graphic videos of the events in Seattle to their officers prior to sending them out to demonstrations. They showed them footage of property damage and people running, quote unquote, amok in Seattle, to really to try and pump the police officers up about creating a preemptive sort of response to demonstrations and street protests in our country in this time. And that in particular in Chicago, there were training sessions on dealing with demonstrators that the Chicago police conducted, where they start with an inspirational story about a 333 BC battle between 30,000 warriors of Alexander the Great, who were able to destroy or capture 300,000 soldiers of the King of Persia. Now, this is what police officers are told about before they're sent out to protect a demonstration, right? So this is the mindset that we're encountering now and have been at different levels and in different ways in the past. But I think that's important for us to remember that these videos they show are entitled Battle Over Seattle, Anatomy of a Riot. That again, and the other context of this is within this last 5 years, the city of Chicago went into court to change this consent decree from the 70s and the Red Squad, saying we've been so good all these years, loosen up a little and let us do a little bit of infiltration. And really, this has not been a problem. And they were successful in the Seventh Circuit. And the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals actually said that times have changed, and that the police department now must be able to investigate terrorists, but wouldn't be able to violate anyone's constitutional rights. Which, as we all know, as we hear more and more and see more and more about the Patriot Act, this becomes a very fine line. The Patriot Act, which targets domestic terrorism, includes, quote, dangerous activities that violate law and appear to be intended to influence policy of a government by intimidation. Now that is a really broad statement. And many folks have expressed apprehension about how this law may be extended and enforced. One of the examples, as you may know, is a few years ago in Des Moines, the government tried to get lists of people at a university who attended an anti-war teach-in such as this, in order to get that information to the government. Now, there was a public outcry about that, and they backed off. So again, that's another lesson to us, that we don't need to sit back and let these things happen. I'm going to move along, huh? So the other issues that other people have raised about the Patriot Act are that if we look at some of our history, that actually those of us in the anti-apartheid movement who were supporting what is now the current government of South Africa, but the African National Congress, would have been labeled a terrorist organization. And any of us who supported them, gave them material aid, would have been, you know, targets under the Patriot Act today. So, and the other issue in this context is September 11th. And September 11th has emboldened law enforcement to stifle demonstrations, is my opinion. And I think it's also made many of us demonstrators somewhat concerned about these and maybe less willing to be seen as militant to others or from the government. So I think that that's something else that we kind of need to keep in mind. But this has all led to police across the country focusing on preemptive strikes to prevent so-called illegal activity before it occurs. This is why at demonstrations now, they are much more reactionary, in my opinion, and that the recent responses to the anti-war movement and the anti-globalism demonstrations is an example of this. And there are examples across the country. Undercover cops in the District of Columbia use pepper spray within a packed anti-inauguration demonstration. They illegally entered and shut down an activist headquarters for supposed housing code violations just before a planned anti-globalization demonstration. And in September of 2002, a very similar thing happened in D.C. that happened here in March of 2003, which is that 400 people were corralled and wrongfully arrested in Pershing Park in Washington, D.C. In California, the police broke a woman's arm with a baton at an anti-war demonstration. And here in Chicago, the VODAC case that we've talked about, VODAC v. City of Chicago, where the police unlawfully corralled 800 to 1,000 people and took to jail more than 500. The National Lawyers Guild and the Jim, with the assistance of Melinda and I and Joey Mogul, brought this lawsuit within a month of the demonstration, asking that it be certified as a class so that each individual didn't have to come forward and assert their rights on their own and go through all depositions and having to deal with lawyers and all the things that litigation requires. And unfortunately, we still await a decision on that. So we've taken about 100 or sat through a combined 100 depositions. They have randomly kind of selected demonstrators to depose, and we have taken many police officers, many of whom, interestingly enough, and hearkening back to other history, have said they were just following orders. People were injured when police used wooden bullets, rubber bullets, tasers, beanbags, and pepper spray to control or disperse crowds or demonstrations. I mean, this is something that, these are what law enforcement term less than lethal weapons. And these have been used more and more against demonstrators across the country. We haven't seen it in Chicago. In fact, we believe that activists were able to dissuade the police from using tear gas on March 20th, 2003. But in Portland, Oregon, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in Miami, Florida, the police have all used these type of weapons with demonstrators, pepper spray and rubber bullets. And I guess I'm listening to myself and I'm thinking, boy, she's really going through a negative thing and this is heavy what the police are doing. And I do think it is, but I don't think that it can be stopped. I think there needs to be a public outcry, not only about what happens in Chicago, but what happens in other countries. Sometimes I believe, when I walked across the street at a demonstration with a photographer of the Guardian, and the police said, hurry up, and they didn't think he was moving fast enough, and he had the audacity to say, I have a First Amendment right to walk in the street, that got him arrested. But arguing with a police officer, and I ran after him, shrieking at the cop, telling him that case law says that arguing with a police officer is not disorderly conduct, so what are you charging him with? You can't find anything to charge him with, and the police are going to sort it out when they get back to the station. So that's a reality that we have to live with. But I also believe that the outcry about these type of police tactics is beginning and can continue and will continue, and that lawsuits play a part in this across the country, that municipalities have investigated the misconduct of their police departments. In fact, in the District of Columbia, we did it here. Alderman Joe Moore did an investigation of what happened on March 20th, but unfortunately not too much came out of that, but it was an exposure, and people did testify about what happened.
We were just saying there was no support for Joe Moore from the city council,
right?
Basically.
Right.
Only a few aldermen.
He was on his own. Mm-hmm. So, but in D.C., they did a real investigation. Their entire city council. They generated a big, thick report. And they concluded that not only the Metropolitan Police Department in D.C., but the mayor's office engaged in wholesale violation of constitutional rights of political activists through infiltration, surveillance, preemptive actions, and wrongful arrests. And they were very strong on what had happened in the Pershing Park incident and in the precursors to the anti-globalization demonstrations in D.C. in 2002. So I guess I would just say in conclusion that it's only by remaining vigilant and vocal that we can preserve, protect, and practice our important constitutional rights. And I would encourage us to continue to do that.
You've been listening to Janie Hawk speaking at the National Lawyers Guild teach-in titled Activists Know Your Rights, which took place at DePaul University Law School on Saturday, October 15, 2005. Coming up, Jim Fennerty has vital advice for protesters, and we'll look at bird flu hysteria. We're coming to you from the trenches.